From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The Prince of Darkness, Satan, Loki, Beelzebub, whatever you call him, the devil is the ultimate bad guy. He tempted Eve with the apple and traded Faust for his soul. This hour, we're taking a closer look at the devil. We'll even talk to the devil himself, or at least someone who's sung for him for years, opera bass Samuel Raimi.
Most people who know me think that I'm a relatively nice guy, you know, and they're always very surprised that I can be so mean on stage.
And what does the devil look like, anyway? For many, he's a guy in red, with horns and a pitchfork. But for Dante, the devil was a giant monster with enormous bat wings and three heads, frozen in the inferno.
Tears from his six eyes, mixing with a flow of bloody slobber, dripped down his three chins. Just as a hackle mangles flax, a row of teeth in each mouth gripped a soul. He made three spirits suffer unremitting woe.
But first, Blanche Barton is the former high priestess of the Church of Satan. She took over the post from the notorious Anton LaVey at his death in 1997. LaVey founded the Church of Satan in 1966 and wrote the infamous Satanic Bible, a book that has sold over a million copies. Steve Paulson caught up with Blanche Barton and asked her what may seem like an obvious question. Does the Church of Satan worship Satan the way other churches worship God?
The idea of worshiping Satan is ridiculous. We worship ourselves, first and foremost, and we use the satanic as a metaphor for calling forth the powers within ourselves that we find enriching or enlivening. Satan has always been a metaphor of defiance, fortitude against all odds, self-determination. In whatever guises he is represented. And there has always been a satanic figure in every culture from the very beginnings of man. And I imagine there always must be.
But you could call your church the Church of Rebellion or the Church of Defiance. I mean, Satan is a very loaded word and frankly, a turnoff to a lot of people. Why choose that figure of Satan?
We do that, Steve, exactly because of what you just said. It is loaded. Words are very powerful. Words are magical incantations, whether you're talking about Democrats and Republicans or Osama bin Laden or Adidas. They're all loaded with something behind them, and Satan has a lot of baggage. And I think by calling what he started the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey was underlining the fact that we are manipulated by language and that we should use it to our advantage, not be intimidated by things that are sold to us as evil. We should be very careful about things that are sold as wicked.
Well, speaking of words, it's striking that you use the name Satan rather than the devil. And I think Satan is even more powerful. I mean, the word Satan is even more powerful than the devil.
Satan is the adversary, the other, the outsider, and it is potent. Satan, in all of his guises, Lucifer, Prometheus, the fallen one, isn't he the best representative for the human? We both share the fall from grace, and we use whatever methods we can find for ourselves to redeem ourselves if redemption is what we want. We can't be redeemed by somebody saving us. We have to summon up the power within ourselves. No one's going to come along and save us.
What are the Church of Satan's core beliefs?
Well, we do have the nine satanic statements. I don't know whether you want me to read them or not.
Sure.
Well, this was published originally in 1969, and it's the core beliefs that all Satanists who understand what Anton LaVey put forth live by. Satan represents indulgence instead of abstinence. Satan represents vital existence instead of spiritual pipe dreams. In all of their guises. Satan represents undefiled wisdom instead of hypocritical self-deceit. Satan represents kindness to those who deserve it instead of love wasted on ingrates. Satan represents vengeance instead of turning the other cheek. Satan represents responsibility to the responsible instead of concern for psychic vampires. Satan represents man as just another animal, sometimes better, more often worse, than those that walk on all fours, who because of his divine, spiritual, and intellectual development has become the most vicious animal of all. Satan represents all of the so-called sins as they all lead to physical, mental, or emotional gratification. And most importantly, number 9, Satan has been the best friend the church has ever had, as he has kept it in business all these years.
Okay, well, let me follow up on number 9. You're saying that without the concept of Satan, the church, particularly the Christian church, would have a hard time justifying itself?
There always has to be that balance. Not necessarily good versus evil, but what God represents generally. We're talking metaphorically, of course. Whether you believe in an actual God or not, that's your business. But metaphorically, at least, he represents conventionality, predictability, the safety of being within the norms and staying within the bounds of propriety. But there always have to be those pioneers, the ones who color outside the lines, the blasphemers, the ones that are unpredictable and unconventional, the bohemians. And that is the constant interplay of humanity. That's how we move forward and then pull back. That's the swinging of the pendulum. And that satanic element will always be there.
Now, one thing that's striking about a lot of these satanic statements is they basically praise selfishness and hedonism. Is that a fair way to characterize what the Church of Satan believes in?
Well, selfishness is very practical. I think we're all selfish, and for a very good reason. Of course, what gives me pleasure is often contributing to society, contributing to those who mean the most to me, my parents, my children, my friends. And there is certainly room for love and even sacrifice for a Satanist. But unlike many other spiritual religions, we don't need a good guy badge. Anton LaVey used that as a phrase, meaning a big patch on your chest or on your sleeve that says, I'm a good guy, I'm doing good things, I'm a white witch, I'm okay. We understand that it's not necessary to do that. You don't have to broadcast it, but it's necessary and it feeds you. What is selfish for me, it gives me pleasure to see people I love happy.
Well, when I listen to you, I mean, you seem very serious about all of this, and yet as you were reciting these 9 satanic statements, there's a certain element of a joke in all of this. I mean, or having fun with the whole concept of the commandments. I mean, for instance, number 5, Satan represents vengeance instead of turning the other cheek. I mean, I get the sense that there's a little bit of a chuckle as that statement was devised. Am I right about that?
Well, there is definitely a chuckle and a wink. Anton LaVey came from a carny background. He was a man of music. He was a musician in his soul and by practice, but he also recognized the sense of humor. And a magician is not worth his salt if he doesn't have a sense of humor and a sense of perspective about himself. Pretentiousness is one of our sins. And every time, whenever Anton LaVey was interviewed or in his writings, you'll notice that if he starts slipping into pedantry, he tends to undercut it with a joke. He turns it around. I think it's always necessary. But if you interpret that as saying that he was just selling this to people, that would be wrong, because Satanists are very serious about this philosophy. But we also understand that humor is one of humanity's saving graces.
Now, there's a popular image of what satanic worshipers do. There are animal sacrifices and altars of naked women, the black mass. Is any of this what you do?
Well, we definitely use the altars of naked women. We glorify the flesh, and so what's more fleshly and enticing and lovely than the naked female form? So in group rituals, sometimes we choose that. In solitary rituals, obviously, we don't. But there are no animal sacrifices, actually. If you read the Satanic Bible, it's very clear that we consider children and animals the most native magicians, because they're the most influenced by their purest instincts, and they don't have the layers and layers of social conditioning laid upon them.
Now, we've been having fun to some degree with this whole idea. I mean, you're poking fun at religious traditions, but there is a dark side to the whole tradition of satanic worship. I mean, some people have really run with this and done some horrible things. I'm thinking of Charles Manson, who committed his atrocious murders invoking Satan, as I recall. And I guess the question is, does your church, the Church of Satan, have any responsibility for some of those people who go off the deep end?
There are always the darker myths. And Satanists, true Satanists, use them to combat your own fears and that which holds you back from your best accomplishments. There will always be those who use whatever they want to justify their violence or their counterproductive actions. And Satanists recognize them for what they are and believe that they should be punished accordingly.
Now, I'm willing to bet that a lot of people would see Satan, the very idea of Satan, as a construction of Christianity, and the Church of Satan is sort of the flip side of that, the inversion of core Christian beliefs. And I guess it raises the question, does your church only work in a largely Christian culture?
No. As I was saying earlier, there's always the satanic, whether it's Sumeria or ancient Greece or some unimaginable culture in our far-flung future, there will always be the outsiders, the pioneers, the blasphemers, and they will always, by whatever name they are conjured, they will always be the ones exploring the murkier borderlands where discoveries are made.
Blanche Barton is the former High Priestess of the Church of Satan. She's the author of the book called The Church of Satan, A History of the World's Most Notorious Religion. Steve Paulson spoke with her. You're listening to Franz Liszt's Mephisto Waltz. Classical music, especially opera, loves the devil. Bass Samuel Ramey should know. Ramey spent the last 30 years playing the devil in leading opera houses all over the world. His recent collection of arias is called A Date with the Devil. Ramey told Anne Strainchamps about the different devils he's sung.
There's Mephistopheles, Boito's Mephistopheles. There's Gounod's Mephistopheles from Faust. There's Berlioz's Damnation of Faust, also Mephistopheles. There's Nick Shadow in Stravinsky's Rake's Progress. There's Bertrand and Robert le Diable. There's the four villains from Tales of Hoffman who are kind of devilish type characters.
Well, how different are they all?
They're all very different. Very different stylistically, musically.
In terms of the devil's character?
They're all quite different, actually, because it's all different styles of music, you know, mm-hmm. So that's going to also affect how you portray a character as well.
Well, for instance, you've really championed the Boito opera, right? That version of...
Yes, right.
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
What's that devil like?
That's probably the most, I mean, really devilish part. I mean, really nasty character. You know, he's probably the nastiest of all of them. You see him more the devil as you expect to see what the devil looks like. Gounod's Mephistopheles and Berlioz's Mephistopheles are both really the devil in disguise. You know, they're very charming, bon vivant type gentlemen, you know, usually. And Nick Shadow from The Rake's Progress is also a very, of course, they're also depending on the production, but he can be also a very sort of charming.
So the devil can either be a very seductive, smooth, sophisticated.
He has to be.
Or he can be immediately terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Huh.
Now, what do you do vocally to create those different types of devils?
Well, there are some vocal effects that you can insert, shall we say, to sort of give a evil, demonic sort of character to the voice, you know. It's sort of, as my teacher likes to call it, you know, you need to give a little snarl in your voice. Your voice has to have a little snarl.
Is the snarl in the Boito style, the out-and-out evil devil?
Well, yeah, a lot of it in that part. But also in the Gounod and the Berlioz, there can be a little bit of that too, you know, once in a while. Because, you know, once in a while, his evilness sort of comes through.
Now, So many of the roles of the devil that you've played have been in different versions of the story of Faust mm-hmm. and Mephistopheles.
Right.
What do you think is the appeal of that particular story, that it's lasted so long and there's so many different versions of it?
I don't know. I think it's just the appeal of, you know, the man being tempted by evil and the eventual triumph of good over evil. I think that's really what draws people to the basic story.
Triumph of good over evil, but at some loss.
Yeah, maybe some. Yeah, some loss.
Chantons à cette belle une chanson morale pour la pègre.
Does he develop in the Gounod or the Berlioz? Does he start out simply charming and smooth, and then does he get sort of darker and scarier as the opera goes on?
Yes, to a certain extent, yeah. It also depends on the production. There's one scene in Gounod's Faust, which is the Walpurgis Night scene, which is supposedly takes place, you know, in sort of a hell, a representation of hell. And it's a big orgy scene, and that's where he's sort of his nastiest. But very often that scene is cut because it's also a scene with a lot of ballet, and many opera companies don't like to go to the expense of using the ballet. And it also makes it forever, but makes for a very long evening as well. But the, in general, I think, yeah, the character can, depending on the production, can go that way. He gets darker as the evening goes on.
What do you love about playing the devil? Is it an especially enjoyable role? Is it simply that the music is ravishing and it's wonderful to have a chance to sing that music? Or
well,
is there, you know, the role itself?
It's really the part. I mean, it's, you know, I always say, you know, the bad guys always have more fun than the good guys, you know. I very seldom get to play a really good guy. But it's really the parts, because they're, you know, they're very dramatic. They call for good acting, and those are the kind of parts that I like to do, you know, that have real personality and real character.
Though some people, I suppose, might have trouble calling out an evil persona in themselves over and over and over again.
Well, maybe some people, I don't know. Most people who know me think that I'm a relatively nice guy, you know, and they're always very surprised that I can be so mean on stage.
Samuel Ramey's new CD is called A Date with the Devil. Anne Strangeshemp spoke with him. Later this hour, take a tour through Dante's Inferno and meet the devil.
The devil, when he is finally seen at the very end of the poem, is not quite the figure of Halloween costumes and cartoons. For one thing, he is huge, immensely huge, and he has three heads and six wings, and he is imprisoned in the ice, frozen there eternally.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Steve Kissing had a normal childhood, growing up in a working-class neighborhood in Cincinnati, Ohio. He played sports, he goofed off in class, he thought girls were icky. Typical American kid. Except for one little thing. Satan. Kissing's the author of a book called Running from the Devil, a memoir of a boy possessed. He told Anne Strangeshamps about the first time Satan paid him a visit.
Well, the first one goes back to fifth grade, which would have been about 1974, and it was the end of a school day, or near the end, and I was in social studies doing what I would have been doing usually, which is in part trying to pay attention to the teacher and in part trying to distract my classmates. And out of the blue, Satan arrived, and I lost touch with reality. Everything that I was seeing took on a different meaning. And I could actually feel my brain which is such an unusual thing. We're not accustomed, of course, to feeling our brain, but I felt mine that day, and it felt as if it were turning to concrete. And my head tingled some. And I didn't hear voices per se, but something similar, kind of a garbled sort of sound. And it just freaked me out. And when I came back around to reality, which was but just a handful of seconds later, though it felt much, much longer, I was quite frightened.
Why didn't you tell anybody? I mean, why didn't you raise your hand and say, help?
For several reasons. One is that I couldn't find the words to describe just what was happening to me. It was one of the hardest things about writing the book, was finding the words now as an adult to explain those eerie and troublesome hallucinations. And in addition to that, and perhaps even more importantly, it was fear. It was fear that if I were to step forward and acknowledge these things were happening to me, it would be sure evidence that I was not being a good boy, and I would have to come forward and admit all my wrongdoing and perhaps be sent away for treatment and who knows what else in some dark dungeon of a room.
You said Satan arrived, but is that really what you thought from the very first moment?
Well, the first few episodes, I was unsure. However, when I had one shortly thereafter in church, I was then convinced that something this unsettling, this bizarre, this scary, and something that could penetrate what I had seen as the force field around St. William's Church, where I went to school and attended Mass, it could be nothing but the work of a demon of Satan. And yes, at that point, I believed it heart and soul.
Were there satanic overtones to your hallucinations? I mean, were you seeing devil figures or pointed spears or, I don't know, pits of flame?
No, nothing that would kind of scream Satan in that sense. It was the fear and the chaos of it which struck my heart and my mind as the work of the devil.
So what did you do then?
Well, I set out on a path to purify myself and to strengthen myself through several ways, mind, body, and spirit. So I worked hard at school to get good grades, A's and B's, and to strengthen my body, I turned to long-distance running, like a man possessed, no pun intended. By seventh grade, it wasn't uncommon for me to run as many as 50 miles in a week, and I thought that that would strengthen me, help me fight off these attacks, and in a way also please God by virtue of keeping my bodily temple in great shape. And then also for my soul, for the spiritual aspect of my life, I did any number of things that I thought then as a child would help protect me. So I became an altar boy, for instance. I later became very involved in my parish youth group, and I even conducted my own silly little exorcisms at home.
Wait, you did exorcisms on yourself? How?
Yeah, that was strange. Any time I had an opportunity, which meant no one else could be home, my parents and siblings had to be gone. I had to be left alone, because if anyone were to witness this, it would mean bad things for me. So I would shut the drapes, and I would get the family Bible and a crucifix. I had a little bottle of, well, it was a grape juice bottle that had later been filled with holy water that was given to me by a nun, as well as a votive candle that I stole from church. And so I would arrange all of these very neatly on the dining room table, and I'd cross myself any number of times, dozens of times, and I'd say Hail Marys and Our Fathers and Glory Bees, and I'd have a rosary draped around me, and I'd genuflect a few times. And this would all build up toward sort of the high point of the exorcism, which was to take a piece of Wonder Bread and hold it over the votive candle flame in an attempt to purify it and give it demon fighting powers. And then I would eat that little bit of bread or communion, if you will, and then quickly put everything away before either a family member or a friend stopped by, and go about my life feeling at least a little stronger, a little better about things.
It must have been awful then when you had another hallucination.
Yes, and inevitably that would happen just within days or a few weeks later. Yet another one would come and remind me that I had to do yet more good works, say more prayers, and resist temptation, which seemed to be following me at every turn.
And where was God in the middle of all this? You know, while you were fighting this huge battle to preserve your soul from Satan, what was God doing?
God was cheering me on. God was motivating me through my prayers and my altar boy service and such. So I felt that he was on my side, though there were times when I suppose I did feel a bit left alone or abandoned. When I was growing up, there was a lot of talk about guardian angels. And my grandparents would often talk about their guardian angels and wonderful things that had happened in their lives, many of them silly little things, but which they attributed to their guardian angels. And it left me wondering exactly where mine was, if he was still in training or had somehow gone to the dark side himself or what, but I couldn't seem to connect with my guardian angel.
So how long did all this go on?
I managed to keep the secret for roughly 6 years, fifth grade through my sophomore year in high school.
That's incredible.
It is. It weirds me out when I think about it and amazes me that I was able to keep quiet so long. I think to a certain extent it speaks to the tyranny of the secrets that we keep and also to the power of secrets. And once that train has left the station, the longer you keep that secret or hide something, the harder it becomes to come clean, if you will.
So after 6 years of keeping this huge secret under wraps, finally everything was exposed. What happened?
Yes, I had been such a good boy that I earned a trip to this leadership conference in Columbus, Ohio, and this conference was coming to an end with a Sunday brunch. And shortly after dessert was placed in front of me, the sensation came upon me again, and I knew I was going to have another visit. And I had grown quite good at being able to manage that situation in public, and so I just assumed it would come and go as the others had. But it didn't. And I end up coming to in the back of an ambulance as I was being taken to Children's Hospital in that city and had come to realize that I had a full-grown grand mal seizure. And through a series of tests and some doctors and such involved, came to realize that I had been dealing with, in essence, a seizure disorder.
So instead of being possessed by the devil, you were epileptic.
Mm-hmm. Though it was a hard thing for me to accept, at least initially. As strange as it sounds, I think there was some disappointment in it, and that, you know, here I had imagined myself in this great battle between dark and light and good and evil, and it turned out to be something other than I had thought. And so there was some disappointment in that, and I suppose in part connected to a sense of embarrassment that I had actually allowed myself to think this and to believe it for so long and to not have stepped forward and asked for help or talked to someone.
We've been laughing about it, and, you know, it is a funny story, but it must have felt really scary to you at the time.
Yes, there were moments of considerable fear and tears involved, too, and some cursing at my higher power, which only made me feel worse after I had done that on a few occasions. Yeah, it was certainly tough at times, but overpowered, I guess, by the joys of youth and the beauty and the majesty of the faith as well. So kept me plugging along.
Steve Kissing's the author of the book called Running from the Devil, a memoir of a boy possessed. And Strange Champs talked with him. Kissing took medication for his seizure disorder for years, but then the seizures ended as mysteriously as they arrived. He is still a practicing Catholic.
Satan is real, working in spirit. You can see him and hear him in this world.
Nel mezzo del cammin de nostra vita, mi ritrovai per una selva oscura, che la dritta via era smarrita.
That's Michael Palmo reading the beginning of Dante's Inferno. Dante wrote the poem in Italian over 700 years ago. Palmo is the translator of a new American edition. The Inferno is part of Dante's Divine Comedy and one of the greatest works of literature ever written. For those of you who don't speak Italian, here is Palma reading the same passage in English.
Midway through the journey of our life, I found myself in a dark wood, for I had strayed from the straight pathway to this tangled ground. how hard it is to tell of. Overlaid with harsh and savage growth, so wild and raw the thought of it still makes me feel afraid. Death scarce could be more bitter. But to draw the lessons of the good that came my way, I will describe the other things I saw.
Michael, tell me, why after 700 years are we still talking about this poem?
The first and most obvious reason is that it's a great work of literature. It's beautifully written. It presents vivid characters with recognizable human nature. And some very bizarre and exciting things happen along the way. These days, perhaps it's even more relevant in many people's minds as they feel that they live in a world beset with evil, and they search for some explanation, some sense of a larger meaning or plan to it all.
Is that what it's all about, really? I mean, I think a lot of us have a feeling that we know Dante's Inferno, but I'm guessing that there aren't nearly as many who've read it as sort of think they have. Can you sort of give us a Cliff Notes version of the Inferno?
Well, several things would probably surprise people who have never read it but think that they have some general sense of it. For one thing, I would imagine we mostly have the traditional view of hell as a place of nothing but fire, whereas Dante's hell is very structured, very complicated, with different punishments along the way to fit the different crimes. Another thing that would surprise many people, I believe, is the degree of severity with which different crimes are punished. We would think that the violent are the worst offenders. And you would think that murderers and tyrants would be in the very deepest pit of hell. And yet, in fact, they're punished relatively lightly in comparison to, say, liars and even flatterers. And the reason for this is that Dante feels that those who have misused reason, which is God's gift by which we know right and wrong, have committed worse offenses than those who have merely acted out of violent animal instincts that we share with the lower creatures.
Before we actually take a step into any of the circles of hell, we ought to talk a little bit about Dante. He's inseparable from the Inferno now. Was it his greatest work?
Oh, without question. And very possibly the greatest work of poetry in the entire European tradition. As you say, he is inseparable from the poem, largely because he has inserted himself directly into the center of it. His narrator shares Dante's name, shares the facts of Dante's life. Thus, to know something about Dante's life is to read the poem in a richer and a deeper way.
Tell us a little bit, if you will, about who he was, about the political context in which he wrote this work.
Well, the Pope, who was reigning at the time that the Inferno was set, he died shortly before Dante began to write the poem several years later. But in the year 1300, when the Inferno was set, the Pope was Boniface VIII, who is pilloried throughout the poem for his corruption, for his abuses, for his having turned the papacy, basically, into a tyranny.
Dante couldn't have made himself too popular with this kind of diatribe against the Church then, could he?
Indeed not. And as a result, he was persona non grata in his city of Florence. He was exiled, banished, ultimately put under penalty of death, and in fact spent the last two decades of his life as an exile, wandering from one city to another in northern Italy, finally winding up in Ravenna, where he died in 1321.
How many circles of hell are there? You enter at the beginning of the poem, and he meets Virgil, and he goes for a tour of hell. Basically.
Yes, a guided tour from one end to the other and out the other side.
Does he have any idea what he's about to endure?
None whatsoever. And in the second canto, in fact, there is essentially a debate between Dante, who is, as you might expect, extremely nervous and fearful of what is about to occur, who would just assume that this cup passed from his lips. But once he is persuaded that those in heaven who have his best interests in mind feel that he needs to take this journey in order to ultimately join them in heaven, he is finally persuaded to go.
And the suggestion is, by implication, that each of us should make this journey, whether in his company or on our own, in order to better ourselves?
Yes, exactly. This, of course, is within the fiction of the poem, this is Dante's reason for describing his tour for the rest of us, so that we can take the journey with him at this remove and ourselves be enlightened as to what may be the folly of our present way of living and how and why we should correct that course before it's too late.
Well, let's talk a little bit about his expectations. I'm curious, I guess, to know how you think they compare to ours. I mean, we think about hell as a place of eternal fire and damnation, and the devil as a horned creature with a pitchfork and a tail. Was that what Dante expected?
He never precisely says what his expectations are, though he does continually suggest that whatever they may have been, they're defeated at every turn by what he actually sees. Very frequently there are variations on the statement, "Nothing could have prepared me for what I saw next." And the devil, when he is finally seen at the very end of the poem, is not quite the figure of Halloween costumes and cartoons. For one thing, he is huge, immensely huge, and he has three heads and six wings, which flap continually, and he is imprisoned in the ice, frozen there eternally, which may be a way of suggesting that while his spirit is still loose in human nature, ultimately his imprisonment bodes well for the salvation of humanity.
I'm curious now that you've mentioned him. Can you read a little bit of the text in which the devil finally makes his appearance?
Yes, I'd be happy to. This is in the 34th and last canto of the Inferno, which is, of course, only the first third of the Divine Comedy, the other two components being, of course, the Purgatorio and the Paradiso. So in canto 34 of the Inferno, "From mid-breast he stood out above the ice, the emperor of that realm of misery. And I compare more favorably in size with the giants than would any giant be compared with just his arm. With such a limb, how monstrous must be his entirety. If he was fair, as he is foul and grim, and dared defy his maker, it is well said that all suffering and sorrow flow from him. I stared to see three faces on his head, one of the greatest wonders I had seen yet. The middle one faced forward and was red. The other two were joined to it and set above each shoulder's midpoint, and they went up to his crown where all three faces met. The right one had a whitish yellow tint. The left one had the appearance of the race that comes from where the Nile starts its descent. Two enormous wings spread out below each face, well scaled to such a bird. Never did I see such sails on any ship in any place. His wings were featherless and leathery, just like the long wings of a bat. And since he flapped the six of them incessantly, all Cocytus was congealed by three cold winds. Tears from his six eyes, mixing with a flow of bloody slobber, dripped down his three chins. Just as a hackle mangles flax, a row of teeth in each mouth gripped a soul. He made three spirits suffer unremitting woe."
What is it, do you think, that makes this so interesting to translators in general now? We have several new versions, several new translations of the Inferno that are coming out. Is there something about the world we live in that makes this view of the devil and his domain seem more necessary for us to know about and think about?
Well, Dante obviously pays homage to the devil, as it were, by seeing him as the source of all evil and placing him at the very center of hell. For the most part, Dante does not go out of his way to ascribe people's behavior to the works and pomps of the devil directly. The poem is very much rooted in human nature. The characters that Dante meets do not, for the most part, say, "The devil made me do it," but give very human personal motivations for their actions. So I think that we can relate in that sense. Dante is, after all, basing his poem, as does the Christian tradition, on the notion of free will. If we were merely the helpless slaves of the devil, then obviously our actions would be meaningless, and to punish us for doing that which we were compelled to do would be monstrous. But Dante does instead present people who could have and should have done otherwise, and who enlighten us into their weaknesses, their failings, the temptations that ultimately proved irresistible to them. And this, I think, as much as any other reason, explains the enduring popularity of the Inferno, that we can see ourselves in the characters of the poem. Remote as they may be in time, they are eternal contemporaries in spirit.
Pari te
Michael Palma is the translator of Norton's New American Edition of Dante's Inferno. Coming up, did blues great Robert Johnson sell his soul to the devil?
He himself never actually claimed that he'd done that. What he did do, though, is he did disappear at one point, not being a terribly good guitar player. And when he came back 6 months later, he played incredibly well. How did he get so good so fast?
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. On a long, lonely highway in Mississippi, a young blues guitar player named Robert Johnson came to a crossroads. And there, he sold his soul to the devil to become the greatest blues musician ever. Or so the legend goes. And it's older than Robert Johnson. Adam Gusso is the author of a book called Seems Like Murder Here, Southern Violence and the Blues Tradition. He told Steve Paulson that the crossroads legend started with another great blues man, Tommy Johnson.
Tommy Johnson is the one who told his brother, Liddell, that he had gone and sold his soul to the devil. I can actually read you a brief quote from Liddell Johnson talking about that. This is Reverend Liddell Johnson. "Now, if Tom was living, he'd tell you," he said. "He said the reason he knowed so much, said he sold himself to the devil. I asked him how. He said, if you want to learn how to play anything you want to play and learn how to make songs yourself, you take your guitar and you go where a road crosses, where a crossroad is. Get there, be sure to get there just a little before 12 o'clock that night so you know you'll be there. You have your guitar and be playing a piece sitting there by yourself. You have to go by yourself and be sitting there playing a piece. A big black man will walk up there and take your guitar and he'll tune it, and then he'll play a piece and hand it back to you." Now, this is Reverend Liddell Johnson, who is Tommy Johnson's brother, not Robert Johnson's. So that's where the myth got started.
Riding, going down here, big road by myself, I don't do, hear me talking, putting mama loading, going down here, big road by myself. If I don't care, you gon' care somebody else.
The name that we remember is Robert Johnson, much more than Tommy Johnson.
Much more than Tommy Johnson. And the reason for that is that Robert Johnson wrote and recorded a number of influential songs that had the devil in them. One was Traveling Riverside Blues, where he talked about wanting to let his soul catch a Greyhound bus and ride. And another, of course, was... He said, "Me and the devil was walking side by side, gonna beat my woman till I get satisfied.
Me and the devil was walking side by side. Me and the devil was walking side by side. And I'm going to beat my woman until I get satisfied."
I went down to the crossroads, fell out of my knees.
In Crossroads Blues, which is the one, of course, that all the baby boomers and people like me, who are the generation after the baby boomers, remember because Eric Clapton recorded it with Cream as a live cut. Crossroads Blues, Robert Johnson's song, Johnson says nothing about the devil. In fact, what he says is, "I'm going to stand at the crossroads," and talks about, you know, "I called on God for mercy, said, help poor Bob, if you please." Not talking about the devil at all. So I think that we need to start the conversation by realizing that there's been a little bit of a misconstrual. And the second reason for this and for why Robert Johnson's name is associated with selling your soul to the devil at the crossroads is really those baby boomers, for whom, in a sense, it's like, I think it's partly future shock. I think all Americans are hungry for authenticity and for a kind of mythology that will sustain us in the face of onrushing postmodern civilization. And I think for a lot of people who hunger for something to anchor themselves in, it's a sort of foundational myth. They love this music. Clearly the music traffics in strong stuff, kind of id stuff, you know, deep, deep, dark. And I think the state of Mississippi gets associated with that stuff for various reasons, including a history of deep, dark racial violence. But clearly Robert Johnson has been associated over time with this, even though the historical record, I mean, he himself, so far as I can tell, never actually claimed that he'd done that. What he did do, though, is he did disappear at one point, not being a terribly good guitar player. And when he came back 6 months later, he played incredibly well.
Hmm. So the question then is, how did he get so good so fast?
How did he get so good so fast?
Going back to this original blues myth, supposedly this selling one's soul to the devil happened at the crossroads. So where exactly is the crossroads?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I have a copy of the current issue of Living Blues magazine, which is published on the campus where I teach at the University of Mississippi in Oxford. And there's a two-page ad put out by the Mississippi, what's this, the Mississippi Tourism Council, I guess. It says, "Feels like coming home." All right, it said, "From an inspired place," and there's a picture of the curving Mississippi River, and down below it says, "Grew inspiring legends." But on the first page, it said, "You can experience the blues in the land where the blues was born." And it says, "Tour Mississippi's legendary Highway 61. Somewhere, it says, along this famous highway, a young man named Robert Johnson came to a crossroad. Legend says he made a deal with the devil." And I want to slip into a Southern accent, "his eternal soul," for the ability to wail some serious blues.
But in spite of all this, the myth of the crossroads still is taken quite seriously in the blues, and it has power even with a younger generation. And the actor and blues musician Chris Thomas King comes to mind. Can you tell me about him?
He's a New Orleans-born blues musician, young African-American guy from a family with a pedigree in the blues. His father, Tabby Thomas, was an Excello recording artist. And he's the guy who plays Tommy Johnson in the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, right? But what he's trying to do is be real about where he's coming from musically. His generation is not really a blues generation. It's a rap generation. And what he's trying to do is kind of fuse blues and hip-hop. And he tries to do it in many different ways. And in one of the songs, he has a song called Mississippi Crossroads. And Crossroads is KKK instead of C, Mississippi Crossroads. He talks about going down to the crossroads and all he saw was a tree and a dusty road. And then something about a devil coming up. But what's clear very quickly, he says the devil was basically the sheriff and his hounds and all this. And the sense in which the devil as a way of commenting on white power, sort of invidious white power in the South. There's a refrain to the song, it's kind of haunting. It's Mississippi, goddamn, goddamn Mississippi, and it gets repeated. Of course, that's a kind of sample or version of the Nina Simone song from 1964, Mississippi, goddamn.
We've been talking about the mythic power of all this, but Tommy Johnson, among others, actually claimed he sold his soul to the devil. Did he?
Blues was something that was associated, number one, with the guitar, right? And the guitar was also called the box. The box was considered the devil's plaything among African-American Southerners in that period of time, much less now. But I think back then, W.C. Handy, his first instrument was not a trumpet, actually. This is the father of the blues. It was a guitar. And when he brought the shiny instrument home, he said, "My father said, a box, You know, his father wanted him to be a minister, and so here was this bluesy instrument in his young son's hand. So I'd say if you're Tommy Johnson and you're given your life over to guitar-based blues music, and you really say, what am I going to do? Which one am I going to go with? Is it going to be God or is it going to be this music? I mean, you're not singing gospel. And I think there's a sense in which somebody deciding to commit to a blues life might want to come back and say, as Huckleberry Finn says when he's decided in his antebellum period of time that he's going to help Jim, the slave, escape. And he goes, all right, then I'll go to hell. And I think that's the kind of moment that a Tommy Johnson has and that maybe a Robert Johnson has when you say, I'm going this way. The road not taken might be that way, that kind of life, but I'm going this way with this stuff. You have a conversion experience.
Adam Gusso is the author of the book called Seems Like Murder Here, Southern Violence and the Blues Tradition. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Mean it. Get down.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Devil, program number 720A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Ann Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Kirill Wheeler, Rich Grody, and Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.